All right, so let's start the afternoon session, quantum gravity. The first speaker is going to be John Bias from University of California at Riverside. John is a mathematician. He's in the Department of Math, but for many years he's been interested in theoretical physics. In fact, he runs a column in the internet called This Week's Finds in Theoretical Physics that has been coming out regularly for the last 6 years. He's going to speak to us about spin networks, spin foams, and quantum gravity.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. What?
Never repeat the joke for the web.
No. The web will have to keep itself entertained. So, but the other reason why this talk will have such a strikingly different flavor from the talks of this morning is that quantum gravity is a very different business than classical gravity. In particular, we expect that at the fundamental level, there needn't necessarily be a continuum description of space-time, first of all, and that already makes the pictures look pretty different. And also, on the other hand, we don't expect that the physics will depend on a fixed background metric, so we can't show you nice pictures of, for example, strings propagating in a fixed background metric either. So what I'm going to talk about is various people's attempts to search for a language or a pictorial language to describe the geometry of space and time at the quantum level. And of course, this is extremely speculative in a sense. But it's interesting that the same kind of picture has been approached from two rather different angles. Penrose, quite a while back, invented this concept of a spin network, which in the simplest case, I'll go into a lot more detail, is just a trivalent graph. Where's the pointer? And big pointer. Thanks. So in the simplest case that Penrose considered, a spin network is just a trivalent graph with the edges labeled by spins that satisfy the constraints imposed by the usual angular momentum addition rules at each vertex there. And he was doing this not with any very precise motivation other than elegance. And in other words, he didn't start from a classical theory of gravity and try to quantize it and get these spin networks. He just posited these as a description of what the geometry of space might be like at the fine scale. And then he proved a number of theorems about them, which showed that in some sense, as this network became very large and complicated, it approximated the description of Euclidean flat space, which was sort of interesting, but rather obscure, actually, how that was happening or why it was happening. But then more recently, spin networks have been arrived at from a rather different angle, namely from the approach called loop quantum gravity, where you start with the Einstein equations and try to quantize them in a fairly conservative manner, that is, using normal rules for quantization and not adding any extra fields or any extra dimensions or anything. And in that approach, it's quite startlingly, the description of states of space at a given time is again in terms of spin networks, which include these spin networks of Penrose, but also some more general kinds of spin networks. Now, in both of these approaches, or both of these ways that people got at spin networks, there was a glaring problem. Namely, there wasn't a very good understanding of the nature of space-time in this approach. Actually, Penrose originally wanted to use his spin networks as a description of space-time and sort of think of them as some kind of Feynman diagram where these were particles of various spins moving along. But when he actually worked out the consequences, it seemed to fit much better a description of space. And similarly, in canonical quantum gravity, there's, of course, the very well-known problem that it's hard to implement the Hamiltonian constraint, which encodes all the dynamics, and even if you can, it's still hard to understand what to do with it. It's hard to recover a space-time picture of the world. And so recently, people working on loop quantum gravity and also topological quantum field theory have tried to extend this language of spin networks via something called spin foams. And the idea is very simple. It's just that a spin foam is something made up out of two-dimensional surfaces, for example, polygons stuck to each other along their edges, labeled by spins. And when you slice a spin foam, generically you get a spin network. So in other words, if someone asked you in the most naive way to try to possibly guess what could happen to a spin network as time passed, your answer would be a spin foam, something where as time passes, the topology of the network can change. And it turns out that one can obtain this spin foam picture from a number of different angles as well. I think, I'm not quite sure, I haven't checked with him yet, I think Carlo will talk about some things like this tomorrow. Is that true? So I guess I imagine that, among other things, Carlo will talk about, for example, how you can derive this picture starting from canonical quantum gravity, which I won't talk about at all. But one can also arrive at it starting from a sort of path integral approach to quantum gravity. Now, one nice thing about these concepts is that they're quite flexible. Namely, you can consider them either completely abstractly as combinatorial objects without any reference to any manifold that they're sitting in, and that's actually what Penrose wanted to do. Or you can consider them embedded in a pre-existing spatial or space-time manifold, which of course could be a manifold of various different flavors depending on the technical details. Or else you could consider them in a manifold that's been triangulated a particular way, in which case they wind up being related to lattice gauge theory in a way which I'll describe. So there are various ways you can try to use these things. And the goal is to try to come up with a language which is merging quantum theory and general relativity, or mathematically speaking, merging representation theory, because really, as we'll see, these objects really depend on the representations or the representation theory of a particular group, the gauge group. And if you take that to be SU2 or something like the Lorentz group, then it is related to general relativity. If it's fancier, it may be related to fancier theories. So roughly speaking, the language of quantum theory is the theory of representations of various algebras on Hilbert spaces. And we're trying to combine that somehow with the language of general relativity, which is differential geometry. So these are a kind of quantum picture of geometries. And while it's still, I think, quite a bit too early to tell whether this will make contact with real-world physics, what's amazing is, and inspires me to keep working on it, is that it does seem to be exhibiting a beautiful matching of concepts from differential geometry with concepts of representation theory. And for that reason, I think it's a good thing to pursue. And so the ultimate aim here is something that I think one would expect from more or less any approach to a background-free quantum theory, namely a merging of the notion of the quantum state and the geometry of space. So you see, a spin network can be used to describe both the state of space, a quantum state, and also the space itself, if you take the abstract approach in which all there is the spin network itself. And so normally, of course, we separate these two concepts. We say first you take a manifold and maybe equip it with a metric, and then we describe the quantum state of affairs on that background space-time. But in a background-free approach, one eventually wants to not do that, and one needs a unified notion. Similarly, the idea of spin foam is designed to merge the notion of quantum history and the geometry of space-time, where by quantum history, I mean something fairly specific and but perhaps not very familiar. The most familiar example of what I mean by a quantum history would be a Feynman diagram. So Feynman diagram sort of gives you a picture of a history of a bunch of particles doing things, interacting. It's a quantum history, of course, because you need to calculate an amplitude for it and sum those amplitudes to calculate transition amplitudes. Okay, so let me say a little bit now more specifically about spin networks. So Penrose's original spin networks, as I said, were just trivalent graphs labeled by spins, half integers, satisfying these relations which you are familiar from when you're coupling two spin systems and to a third, or the rules for adding angular momentum. And he was doing this in a purely combinatorial way, that is, not thinking of this graph as necessarily embedded in any manifold, although, of course, to draw it, I have to draw it as if it looks like it's embedded in free space. And that was later on realized to be a special case of something much more general that works for any old gauge group, which in this case was SU2, secretly, and for vertices of any valence, which in this case was 3. All the vertices were trivalent. And so the general concept of spin network, which has evolved, is the following thing. It consists of three things. First of all, a graph, gamma, with finitely many vertices and edges, and you should think of the edges as having little arrows on them to really keep track of things, although we didn't do that up here. And then each edge of your graph will be labeled with an irreducible representation of your group G. So, of course, for SU2, that just means labeling each edge by a spin. And then for each vertex, we should label it with an intertwining operator, that is a linear operator with some nice properties, going from the tensor product of all the irreducible representations that label the edges coming into that vertex to the tensor product of all the irreducible representations labeling the outgoing edges. So if you think about it for a while, you see that when the gauge group is SU2 and when the graph is trivalent, all this fancy stuff reduces down to Penrose's original idea, because the irreducible representations are just spins when the group is SU2, and there's really just one intertwining operator from the spin J tensor, the spin K, to the spin L representation in that case, so you don't need to bother labeling the vertices with those intertwining operators. They're just sort of implicit. Now, what can you do with spin networks? Well, the first thing you can do for them, the first thing you can do with them is to get a number out of them. And Penrose figured out a way to do this, but I'll describe it in this more general situation. And it goes like this. You draw your spin network on the plane, and you read it from top to bottom. And you read it as a composite of a whole bunch of intertwining operators, starting out from the trivial representation, which I write as C, and ending up at the trivial representation. And then at every intermediate stage, which representation we've got there is given by taking a horizontal slice of the diagram. So for example, at this particular slice, let's see, I hope I've got this right. Well, actually, these aren't quite matching up with the slices here. At this slice here, for example, we have the representation row 1, because that edge is labeled by row 1. Tensor row 1 dual, because it's labeled by row 1, but the arrow is pointing backwards in time, so to speak. Tensor row 2, tensor row 2 dual. So this particular slice gets labeled by this representation. And then the way you get linear operators between those representations is, again, just by reading off the diagram. For example, here we have an intertwining operator, and so we use that intertwining operator to get us a linear map from this representation to this representation. These maxima and minima give you intertwining operators just because you can pair any representation with its dual and get a map from that to the complex numbers. So, for example, here we have the intertwining operator, which is just the natural pairing between this representation and its dual, mapping down to the complex numbers. So when we do this, when we read the diagram this way, we get an intertwining operator, in particular a linear operator, from the complex numbers to the complex numbers. But what's a linear operator from the complex numbers to itself? Well, it's just multiplication by a number. So from this diagram, we get a number. And Penrose, actually, in the case of SU2, wrote down a purely combinatorial way of calculating this number, but it really is this. Now, that may seem sort of unfamiliar, But in fact, it's something that at least particle physicists do all the time. Because in fact, you can not only evaluate closed spin networks of the kind I've been describing, but also spin networks that have loose ends hanging out like this, which I'll call open spin networks. In that case, you get not a linear operator from the complex numbers to itself, but from some representation to some other representation. Here, for example, from the representation rho 1 tensor rho 2 to rho 3 tensor rho 4. So we get linear operators from little pieces of Feynman diagrams this way. Sorry, from little pieces of spin networks. I'm giving away the punchline here. So the point is, this is supposed to remind you of a Feynman diagram, and in fact, that's not a coincidence. When you take your group to be the Poincaré group, together with whatever gauge group your quantum field theory may have, this way of getting an operator from a diagram is exactly the way one uses to get an operator from a Feynman diagram in quantum field theory. Of course, in quantum field theory, they don't tell you that it's that simple. They tell you, oh, you do all these integrals over momentum space, and it seems very complicated and mysterious, perhaps. But that's, well, of course, this may seem complicated and mysterious. It's sort of a matter of perspective. But I only felt I really understood what Feynman diagram evaluation was about when I saw that it was really just composing a bunch of intertwining operators to get a big fat operator. The big difference, though, between the case when G is something like SU2 and the case when G is the Poincaré group is that in the case when G is the Poincaré group, we get infinities quite often. Namely, we get them more or less whenever our diagram has a loop. And, of course, that's familiar to particle physicists, that it's the diagrams with loops that give you the divergences. But we can see it sort of simply from this perspective. For example, if I take the spin network, which is just a single loop labeled by this representation rho, and just to be legit, I should put a vertex in here too, and label it by the identity operator. And if I evaluate it the way I've described, you just get the dimension of the representation, because that's the trace of the identity operator in that representation. But of course, that will be infinite when G is the Poincaré group and you're using the usual representations they do in particle physics, because those are all infinite dimensional. So in a sense, what this spin network idea is a way of replacing the Poincaré group by other groups, for example, compact groups, which will make the infinities go away in the evaluation of these Feynman diagrams. Okay, so that's sort of the abstract math of spin networks, but what the heck does it have to do with the geometry of space? Well, the way to see that, I think, is to think about some ideas from lattice gauge theory. So suppose that for some reason or other, you decide to represent space as a graph, just a bunch of vertices and edges. And of course, that's what one does in lattice gauge theory. But here, we're not necessarily working with a lattice. We're working with just any old graph whatsoever. So let me tell you about gauge theory on a graph. So I need to tell you what a connection is and what a gauge transformation is. A connection, in this context, will be something that assigns to each edge a group element. That's what they do in lattice gauge theory. It just describes the parallel translation along that edge. A gauge transformation is also simple. It just assigns to each vertex a group element, which you think of as doing a gauge transformation at that point, at each, this should have been a V here. At each vertex, you have this gauge transformation going on. And gauge transformations act on connections in the usual way, that is more or less by conjugation. So if we have some edge, it will start at some point, which I call its source, and end at some point, I'll call its target. And if I want to know how the gauge transformation acts on the connection, I just say, well, I take the group element that the original connection assigned to this edge and multiply it on one end by the group element, the gauge transformation element at this vertex here, and multiply at the other end by the inverse of that. And that's just the usual rule for how the holonomy of a connection along a path changes when you do a gauge transformation to it. So we can do gauge theory in this discrete setting. And as I said, that's what people do in lattice gauge theory. But now I want to tell you what spin networks have to do with that. So spin networks actually define functions on the space of connections. This curly A sub gamma means the space of all connections on this graph gamma, where I define connections on a graph as in the previous transparency. Maybe I should take advantage of this. Sorry. I should have been doing this all along. So we can keep track of what I'm up to. So I want now spin networks to describe states of gauge theory in this discrete context. So I want to tell you how, to each spin network, I get a function on the space of connections. And the way it works is very much like the recipe that I described to you earlier, namely, you draw your spin network and read it from top to bottom to get a linear operator from the complex numbers to itself, which is just a number. The only difference now is that now we have the edges labeled by these group elements. The connection, remember, gives us group elements for the edges. So we basically just stick those into the picture in the more or less obvious way. Namely, for example, here I've got this representation, row 1, labeling this edge, but also this group element, A1. So I get this linear operator, row 1 of A1, and I use that linear operator to describe what happens as I move the horizontal slice past that little circle there containing the A1. So we insert these group elements, as some people say. And so we get a function on the space of connections, which I call a spin network state. And of course, it boils down to the thing we were doing before, when all of these group elements are the identity. So what's important about spin network states is that they form a basis. They form an orthonormal basis, actually. So what I think of as the basic theorem about spin networks and gauge theory is this. These functions on the space of connections that we're getting here are all gauge invariant. And then second of all, when your gauge group is compact, you can choose spin network states that give you an orthonormal basis for the Hilbert space of L2 of the space of connections mod gauge transformations. And technically, of course, we need to know what measure on space of connections mod gauge transformations we're using to talk about L2, and we use the more or less obvious one, namely, the space of connections is just a product of copies of the group, one for every edge in our graph. And that has a nice measure on it, Haar measure. And we can use that measure and then push it down to this quotient space to get a measure on the quotient space. So spin networks, you see, now are taking on a new life, namely as a description of states in gauge theory. Let's see what I want to do with this stuff. But so far, you notice, everything has been very discrete and combinatorial. There's been no reference to a space-time manifold whatsoever, or a spatial manifold. Space was at best just an abstract graph. Now I want to relate this to what people were doing in canonical quantum gravity. These people who were trying to be fairly conservative in the sense that they weren't positing that space was a graph or something like that. They were taking space to be a three-dimensional manifold. So this is a brief summary of a lot of work by Ashtekar, Ravelli, Smolin, Lewandowski, and quite a number of other people. So in Ashtekar's formulation of general relativity, the kinematical configuration space, that is the configuration space before you impose the Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraints, is just the space of connections mod gauge transformations, or more precisely, SU2 connections mod gauge transformations, on a particular three-dimensional manifold which represents space. So at this level, the so-called kinematical level, before you worry about the constraints, you'd expect naively that the Hilbert space would just be L2 of that configuration space. But the problem was, and always is, how do you define that? How do you define L2 functions on some infinite dimensional manifold, or something even worse than a manifold, actually? Well, they figured out ways to do it. And those ways can be described very economically using the language of spin networks, although in a sense it makes it seem too easy. But you'll forgive that, I'm sure. everyone will forgive me except for the people who had to sweat and toil the first time figuring out the answer. So we've seen that any, let's see, I'm using a mixture of stuff that I've already done and some new stuff, so let me phrase it a little bit differently. Suppose we have a spin network whose graph is now not just an abstract graph, but a graph sitting inside the manifold S that represents space. Now I claim that we actually get a function on the space of connections mod gauge transformations from this. And the way we do it is we use the recipe over here, but where do we get these group elements, A1, A2, and so on? We just get those by taking our connection on space and using that to figure out the holonomy along the edge to get a group element. So in other words, I'm taking this abstract construction and now I'm applying it in the case where this spin network is actually living in space and we actually have a connection on space, and that connection is what's giving us these holonomies, AI. So we get a way of assigning, so if you hand me this spin network, I get a state, a function on the space of connections mod gauge transformations. And now we can just say, okay, let's just look at all the states of this form. Let's form a big fat Hilbert space that has all these states in it. So in other words, for any graph in my three-dimensional manifold, I get a Hilbert space, this one that I was talking about over here. But now let's lump them all together, basically take the union of all those and then take its completion to get a Hilbert space. And more or less by definition, or more precisely by this theorem here, that big Hilbert space of states will have a basis given by spin networks. So actually, things weren't arrived at in anywhere nearly this quick a manner. In fact, people had defined the Hilbert space in loop quantum gravity in a rather different way, and it was quite a bit of work to see that the spin networks formed an orthonormal basis of it. And before then, it was actually rather mysterious or tricky to do computations in loop quantum gravity because it's nice to have a handy basis to calculate with. So the spin networks have given a big impetus to calculate specific observables in loop quantum gravity. And I'll just describe one here, namely the area observable. And I use observable in a loose sense, that is, as an operator on this kinematical Hilbert space. So classically, you would expect that such observables would be gauge invariant functions of the connection and its canonically conjugate variable, the thing that's analogous to the electric field, which is called the cotriad field in the Ashtekar formalism. You can think of that thing as being like the square root of the metric in the sense that there's a formula for the metric in terms of this E field, and it involves two of these E fields. So, for example, I can write down the area of some particular surface in our three-dimensional manifold. It's just basically the integral of E, or more precisely, the integral of the absolute value of E, which turns it into an ordinary two form that you can integrate over the surface. And by using usual methods of quantization, you can get an operator corresponding to this, which will be an operator on this Hilbert space. And I'll denote that operator just by sticking a little hat on the E, the way people like to do. And I'll just tell you the final answer. I won't describe the quantization procedure that was used to obtain this. I'll just tell you what it does, what this area operator does when I act on a particular spin network state. And since spin network states form a basis, this is basically good enough. Actually, I'm only going to look at spin network states where the spin network hits the surface in a nice way, that like I've drawn here. That is, none of the edges hit tangentially, and none of the vertices of the spin network lie on the surface. So the sort of generic case, just to keep the explanation simpler. So what I'm saying in this formula here is that this spin network state is an eigenvalue of this area operator. Sorry, it's an eigenstate of the area operator, and the eigenvalue is given by this thing here. It's just a sum over all the points where the spin network hits the surface, and what you add up are a bunch of numbers, which should be familiar from the quantum mechanics of angular momentum. It's just the square root of j plus 1, where j is the spin labeling the particular edge poking through the surface. Actually, I should make a point here that In fact, there are different ways. There's a one-parameter family of ways of doing this loop quantum gravity. And really, there's an ambiguity in this formula. Namely, I could stick in any constant I like in front of this and get an area operator in one of these representations. So that this constant is usually called the Emirtzi parameter, and Abai will talk about it a little bit in his talk on calculating black hole entropy. So the reason why that's sort of important is because it sets the fundamental scale, the fundamental quantum of area. In some sense, you could say the smallest little bit of area in loop quantum gravity is given by the smallest non-zero spin, 1/2. So you get the square root of 3/4 as the fundamental unit of area. But really, you should multiply it, of course, by the Planck length squared to make it dimensionally correct, but then also by this Emirtzi parameter, which is an undetermined parameter in the theory, to get the area quantum. So anyway, the picture of this is that spin network edges, what they really mean is that they're flux tubes of area, roughly as, for example, on a type 2 superconductor, you can have these quantized flux tubes of the magnetic field. Here we're getting quantized flux tubes of this SU2 gauge field, and what it means in the theory is area. And so in particular, the most important robust result is that area is quantized in this theory. And since the big puzzle in black hole entropy is why is area proportional to the entropy for the case of an event horizon, it's natural to try to do a calculation of black hole entropy making use of this idea, and Abai Ashtekar will present a calculation along those lines using this basic formula. Okay, so that's all, unfortunately, I have time to say about spin networks and the quantum geometry of space. I want to turn attention now to something that's a bit different in flavor and more speculative still, in a way, which is what's the description of space-time in this kind of approach. And that's where spin-foam models become important, I believe or hope. So you see there's this problem endemic to any approach to canonical quantum gravity of how do you understand the dynamics of the theory. And in the particular case of loop quantum gravity, it's something that people are battling with very actively, trying to find a formula for the Hamiltonian constraint, for example. And at some point, I became so depressed by this problem that I decided it would be worth spending some energy trying to sidestep it in the sense of developing a, not so much a Hamiltonian approach, but more something like a Lagrangian approach for loop quantum gravity, in which we would have a picture of space-time from the very start. And so the most simple-minded idea is just to think of spin networks evolving in time, which I call spin foams. And so the idea is a spin foam, in the simplest case, would just be a bunch of polygons stuck together along their edges with the polygons labeled by spins. And so the idea is if you take a spin foam and you slice it at some time, quote-unquote, with some surface that represents a constant time surface, then each spin network edge is really coming from a slice of a spin foam face. And similarly, each spin network vertex like this actually came as a slice of a spin foam edge. And so the really new feature of the spin foams is that you have these vertices of the spin foam proper, which is the point at which the topology of the spin network changes as you push forwards a slice, like here a little triangle is being born. And I think of those in a sort of rough and ready way as interactions, that is, processes whereby one spin network can become another. So we can be a bit more precise and define a spin foam. And this definition of a spin foam is supposed to look almost exactly like the definition of spin network that I gave you earlier, except that everything is pushed one dimension up. So a spin foam is a two-dimensional complex, kappa, and I don't want to define what that means, but it's basically a bunch of polygons stuck to each other along their edges. So it has a bunch of vertices, edges, which we orient, and faces, which we also orient. And now, each face of that complex will be labeled by an irreducible representation of our gauge group, and each edge will be labeled with an intertwining operator, which will go from the tensor product of the incoming faces, that is the tensor product of the representations labeling those faces, to the tensor product of reps labeling the outgoing faces. Of course, it's not clear what I mean by an incoming face. What I mean, though, is pretty simple. It's just a face where the orientation of the face matches the orientation of the edge. So that's what I call an incoming face, and this is what I call an outgoing face. So I'm just copying the definition of spin network and pushing the dimension up one notch in order to get something that, when I slice it, gives me back a spin network. And we can also define open spin networks, which I write as F going from psi to psi prime, which go from one spin network to another. In fact, this picture is actually, you could think of it as a picture of a little piece of an open spin network going from some spin network that has a little bit that looks like this in it to some other one that looks like this down at the bottom. So the idea is I want to try to come up with something like a Feynman diagram method for quantum gravity. So I want to calculate amplitudes for my diagrams, but now my diagrams are spin foams. And I'm going to copy the recipe that worked for Feynman diagrams, more or less. Namely, I'll calculate the amplitude of a spin foam by taking a product of amplitudes, one for every face, edge, and vertex. These amplitudes for the faces and edges are analogous to propagators in Feynman diagrams, whereas the amplitudes for the vertices are analogous to the more interesting thing, the interaction amplitudes in the theory, when something actually happens, like here. So a spin net foam is really just a two-dimensional version of a Feynman diagram. Of course, there's some other theory that some people know about that has two-dimensional analogs of Feynman diagrams, and that's called string theory. There, of course, the amplitudes are computed for surfaces, not for these complexes. And they're calculated using a background metric. So they're different in a way. However, I'm thinking more and more that there's actually a deep relationship between those. I could say a bit more about that if someone wanted. I think I'll skip that remark. You can read that remark if you're getting puzzled by how Feynman diagrams are analogous both to spin networks and to spin foams. I think I will skip that, though, because I'm getting on here. So the idea is we'd like to come up with some theory which gave specific rules for calculating face, edge, and vertex amplitudes, which let us calculate amplitudes for transition from one spin network to another, and then show that in some classical limit or other, some large-scale limit, it reduced to some familiar classical theory. The best one would, of course, be general relativity, or general relativity together with lots of other matter fields. But people so far have been more successful in doing this for much simpler theories. To do that, it's good to work in a kind of halfway house, that is, look at spin foams in a particular triangulation of space-time. That's a halfway house between the radical abstract approach where you let your spin foams be the only thing there is, the whole description of space-time is the spin foam, and this other approach where you look at spin foams embedded in a pre-existing smooth manifold. So here's how it goes. So let's think of space-time as some cobordism, that is some n-dimensional manifold going from one n-1 manifold to another. And now let's triangulate the whole affair. Let's triangulate M, and that will therefore give us triangulations for S and S prime. And now let our graph, let's look at a graph in S, and the way we'll do it is take what's called the dual one skeleton of S. So here, this is a bit of my manifold S representing space, which in this example is two-dimensional. And I look at the triangulation of it, and what I do is I make a graph by putting one vertex inside each top-dimensional simplex, that is, in each triangle, and having one edge poking through each simplex of dimension one less than the top dimension. So we get this graph here, which I've stuck some orientations on in an arbitrary way. That's called the dual one skeleton. So if we work with that graph, we can say, let's just think about spin networks that whose underlying graph is that graph. And then we get this Hilbert space of states, L2 of A sub gamma mod G sub gamma. That will have a basis given by all the spin networks that live in this graph. So I'm basically discretizing everything with the help of this triangulation. Not considering all spin networks stuck inside S, but just the ones that are sort of adapted to this triangulation. And why am I doing that? Well, as I said, just purely for reasons of convenience, not for reasons of principle. But we'll see that it's a good thing to do to some extent. And we can do the same kind of thing for our other space, S prime, get another Hilbert space that way. And then the idea here is, from a spin foam model, we want to get a time evolution operator going from one Hilbert space to another. I put this in quotes because there are some people here who know a thing or two about the problem of time in quantum gravity. And, for example, in the case when this space-time was just a cylinder, just a product of space with an interval, what this thing should be is the projection onto the physical Hilbert space. So it's not time evolution in any other sense than that sort of odd one. But anyway, how do we calculate it? Well, the idea is this. To calculate the transition amplitude from one spin network state to another, we just sum over all spin foams going from one to the other, and our spin foam model has a responsibility to provide us with an amplitude for each spin foam. So we sum those amplitudes. And we only look at spin foams that are, again, adapted to this triangulation. They live in what's called the dual 2 skeleton, which has one vertex in the center of each top dimensional simplex. So let's see. In my short remaining time, I want to whiz through a couple of examples of how people have used this approach to study particular theories, because I'm sure all of this stuff, if you've never seen it before, seems like a bunch of abstract nonsense. So there's a simple theory called BF theory, which makes sense in any dimension. In three dimensions, with gauge group SU2, it's very closely related to three-dimensional quantum gravity, actually Riemannian three-dimensional quantum gravity, meaning a theory of Riemannian metrics. In four dimensions, it's sometimes called topological gravity. So this is the Lagrangian for it, but you can quantize it in the spin foam approach, and I'm just going to briefly tell you what the vertex amplitudes are and how you calculate them, and you calculate them in the simplest possible way. Basically, whenever you see a vertex for your spin foam, you draw a little sphere around it, and that will intersect your spin foam to give you a spin network, which in this particular case would look like this. I haven't drawn the labelings of edges by spins, but they're supposed to be in there. And now, I told you there's a recipe for calculating a number from a spin network. That's Penrose's original recipe, basically. And that's the recipe you use to calculate the vertex amplitude in this BF theory. So when you do this, when the group is SU2 and your space-time has dimension 3, you get what's called the Ponzano-Regge model, which is a discrete model of three-dimensional Riemannian quantum gravity. And in this model, it's lengths that are quantized. So if we take one of our spin networks in the dual 1 skeleton, it looks like this. And you can think of those spins as giving lengths to the edges of the triangles in your triangulations. And those lengths are discrete. This theory has infrared divergences, but you can cure those by adding a cosmological constant to your theory. And in the combinatorial formulation, that corresponds to replacing your group by a quantum group, interestingly. This kind of setup works not only in three dimensions, but also in four dimensions. But in four dimensions, you don't get four-dimensional general relativity. You get a much simpler theory, which sometimes people call topological gravity, which is a theory of flat Riemannian metrics. Or they're flat when the cosmological constant is zero. You can also consider the non-zero case. And that, again, works to give you a nice, well-defined quantum theory with no divergences. But those are theories which are topological quantum field theories, meaning they have no local degrees of freedom. They're quantizations of theories where space-time is just flat. So it's not clear that that's very interesting for real physics. So a step towards something more interesting is to look at Riemannian quantum gravity in four dimensions. By Riemannian, I mean that we're not considering a theory of Lorentzian metrics, but of Riemannian metrics. We can write that as a gauge theory where the gauge group is basically SO4, although the double covers a little bit better. And there's a trick that lets you think of this theory as being this theory with some extra constraints added. And so I'm running out of time, so I don't want to go into too much detail here, but you can impose those constraints at the quantum level as constraints on the spin foams that you're allowing yourself to sum over. So normally you sum over all spin foams, but here we sum over spin foams that meet certain conditions, which corresponds to the constraint that this E field in the BF theory is actually coming from a metric, coming from a tetrad field. And when we do that, we get a particular spin foam model called the Barrett-Crane model, which has been studied to a fair extent by now, and it seems like a very beautiful theory. So the basic kind of transition that occurs in this theory is the following kind of thing. So our spin networks are living in the dual one skeleton of a three manifold, so they're all four valent, like this here. And the basic kind of transition from one spin network to another looks like this. One of these four valent vertices breaks apart into four new ones. And so what the responsibility of Barrett and Crane is to give you a rule for calculating that transition amplitude, from what's the amplitude for this to become this. And the way you do it is, again, you draw a little sphere around the vertex here where the interaction occurs. You get a little spin network, which looks like a pentagram, and you evaluate that. But, well, there's some subtleties here that I'm not going into, that the constraints require that the vertices here are all labeled by some special intertwining operator. So in this theory, it's area that's quantized. And the main thing we don't know about this theory, the most exciting thing that I'd like to know about this theory but don't know, is what's the large-scale limit? That is, does it have a well-defined classical limit? Does it approach Riemannian general relativity in some appropriate limit where you view these, where, for example, you look at all the spin foams going from one state to another, and you look at the ones with a dominant amplitude, which should be the ones that approximate classical geometries. We don't know that it has that nice classical limiting behavior that we'd hope for in some theory of quantum gravity. But in this particular setup, he's asking, do we sum over all possible spin foams that go from our initial to our final spin network? So there are two caveats. There are two senses in which the answer is not quite. So the first one is that we've triangulated space-time, so we're only looking at spin foams that live in the dual two skeleton of that triangulation. So we only are looking at spin foams that are adapted to the triangulation here. That makes the sum finite, at least when we go to a quantum group. And then the other caveat is that here in this Crane, in this Barrett-Crane model, the constraints that get us from BF theory to general relativity are imposed as constraints on what spin foams we're summing over. So that also limits things. But apart from that, everything. We sum over them all. And the problem, so that's a well-defined finite sum, which you could, if I was rich enough to afford a supercomputer, I could just calculate away and see what it gave me, but we don't understand what its properties are. We don't understand whether it's giving us a theory that looks like Riemannian general relativity.
So you fix the triangulation, so the topology of the
phone
is fixed and you're only summing over a
representation from the point? Yeah, in this approach, that's right.
But why is even that restricted sum obviously finite?
If that sum would not be finite if we were working with representations of the group SU2 cross SU2, because we'd be summing over all sorts of spins, and there are infinitely many spins. But the interesting thing is, in these theories, when you have there be a non-zero cosmological constant, it turns out it's quite well understood in the three-dimensional case, not so much in the four-dimensional case, but I believe it's true that introducing a cosmological constant corresponds to working not with representations of SU2, but with quantum SU2. And if you do things right, that has only finitely many irreducible representations. And so then that sum really becomes a finite sum. So a way to say it that's sort of vague, and I don't know if it's exactly true, but may give you some intuition, is that somehow introducing the cosmological constant eliminates the infrared divergences that are present in the sun. They really are infrared divergences that are happening when you're considering arbitrarily large spins, because those spins are describing the areas of surfaces. So it's, the idea is we're doing a kind of discretized version of a path integral where we're summing over all four geometries going from one three geometry to another. Naively, what we're doing is we're summing over four geometries that are arbitrarily large in volume, and that's where the divergence is coming from. Putting in the cosmological constant kills off those large ones, makes the sum finite. So let me just conclude by mentioning a few new directions that people have been working on in this line. So at first it was thought it was very special properties of general relativity in four dimensions that even allowed the formulation of this four-dimensional spin foam model. But that has been revealed to be false. One can do it in higher dimensions, and Laurent Freidel and Kirill Krasnov have described spin foam models for Riemannian general relativity in arbitrary dimension. The properties of those models are even more poorly understood than the four-dimensional case. One can also consider larger gauge groups or also supergroups. There's nothing to stop you from working with representations of a supergroup here. And in fact, Ling and Smolin have considered that and come up with what I would call a spin foam model of supergravity in four dimensions, some version of supergravity, I forget which one. One can also try to get around the fact that we're working with Riemannian gravity and try to come up with a Lorentzian version of the model. The most obvious way to try to do that is to replace the representations of SO4 by representations of SO31 in here. There's a lot of reasons to think that that's a well-motivated thing to do. However, the unitary representations of SO31 are infinite dimensional. So you get infinities when you try to evaluate spin networks using the recipe I described. So Barrett and Crane have come up with a formal model of Lorentzian quantum gravity, but it's formal in the sense that the amplitude, which looks exactly like this, we're just replacing SO4 by SO31, but now this amplitude is a divergent sum, so we don't know what it means. We don't know. It doesn't really exist yet. We'd have to somehow regularize it or something to get something out of it. That's somewhat touchy. The quantum Lorentz group and its representations are not as well understood as they should be. So there are different choices of sign of the cosmological constant and so on that you'd need to consider. So I can't completely say it's been ruled out that some way of going through a quantum group might finitize things. But at least some ways of doing it do not. At least some. So the things that they tried were not able to get rid of that divergence. That made me very unhappy. One could try to better understand the role of causality in these spin foam models in general. Fotini, Marco Pollu, and Lee Smolin have been working on that. That should really eventually intermesh with this Lorentzian idea, but so far it hasn't. Then there are various ways you can try to get around the problem here of fixing a triangulation from the very start. There wasn't any particularly good motivation for fixing a particular triangulation and only summing over the spin foams that fit inside that triangulation, at least not in Riemannian quantum gravity. In BF theory, it can be retroactively justified because you can show that the results don't depend on the triangulation. That's a marvelous feature of the BF theory spin foam models. But that feature is almost certainly not true of this model, and so it seems as if you are actually introducing some foreign background structure into the theory when you're picking a triangulation, and you'd like to get rid of that somehow or other. There are various ways to try to do that. One is to directly work in the continuum. So Mark Reisenberger and Carlo Rovelli have been doing that, starting from formulas for the Hamiltonian constraint in quantum gravity. Another approach is to somehow sum or average over triangulations. There are various projects underway in that direction, or maybe take a limit in which the triangulations become ever finer. People are a bit confused about what the right thing would be to do. Or another one is to throw out this background manifold entirely and just sum over all abstract spin foams. And I think, in some sense, ultimately, if you believe in this idea that we're replacing the continuum description of a manifold by a discrete one, ultimately, you should probably throw it out altogether. And various people have been working on that. These authors have been writing a paper which does that. I'm also interested in that. There's a lot of interesting contact to be made with string theory. Lee Smolin has, for example, formulated a spin foam model, which he claims is the spin foam model for M theory. And luckily, of course, M theory is so poorly understood, no one can can refute that at present. But I think there are specific features relating conformal field theories and these quantum groups, which suggest that there really should be some connection to string theory. And I'm in particular interested in contact with mathematics of N categories, and in particular this some fancy algebra that lets you consider spin foams that are higher in dimension and would be labeled by representations of some fancier algebraic gadgets, and maybe they're a bit like the brains that string theorists are talking about these days. So anyway, those are some directions, and I don't by any means mean to suggest that we understand what's going on very well. What I hope I've gotten across, and I'm not sure if I have gotten across, is that the algebra of group representation theory winds up fitting very nicely into geometry and giving us a new way of thinking about geometry. And I think that if anything of this persists, it will be that, this linkage between quantum mechanics and general relativity. And I think we're just groping around trying to find good ways to use that to build up a theory in this new language. Thanks.
Would you view the four-dimensional Riemannian quantum geometry as a theory in itself that would coincide with what you're building up with SO31 by taking asymptotic amplitudes and continuing them back? Or is it just a sort of test?
I'm not quite sure I understand your question, because there are at least two different things you can do, and that sometimes get a little bit conflated. So one is to...
Let me shorten my question.
Okay.
Is there any physical content to Riemannian quantum geometry?
Not directly that I know of, not in terms of our real world.
Thanks.
I just wanted to say that it's...
Perhaps the question has a certain historical context, namely that for many years people were doing path integrals for Riemannian theory with the expectation that would have relevance for...
Oh, yeah, but let me point out that's the distinction I was going to try to make. There are two very different things you can do. One is you can... let your metric be Riemannian and replace e to the I times the action in your path integral by e to the minus the action. That's what was done in Hawking's work, for example. And there's a big debate that's been underway for years as to how relevant that is to physics. But this theory here that I'm describing is not that, because what we're doing here is we are replacing the metric by a Riemannian metric, but it's not apparent from anything I've written here, but we're quantizing a theory in which you're working with e to the I times the action.
Where's the I?
Well, I didn't derive these rules from the path integral, but if you and any such derivation's a little bit heuristic, but if you do it, you see that these rules are related to discretizing e to the I times the action, not e to the minus the action. So that's why I was using Riemannian quantum gravity to maybe distinguish it from Euclidean quantum gravity. All these terms are a little bit frustrating, but there are two different theories there.
Connected with this discussion, in the older days of quantum field theory, the discovery was made that you can simplify the Slater-Whiteman program of quantum field theory by going from the Whiteman distributions to the Schwinger functions, mm-hmm. and somehow connected with the last question, this would raise the idea whether if you would have this SO4-based formalism with this thing, whether there would be some trick to, in a similar way, go back to Lorentzian by this type of situation, by this...
Right, that's an interesting idea. Actually, in the case of three-dimensional gravity, John Barrett has an interesting paper trying to relate this Riemannian theory to the Lorentzian theory by doing a kind of continuation. But I think that's a very tempting thing to try to do, because as soon as you go to the non-compact group, things blow up. But I don't know any way to really go in that direction yet.
Mm-hmm. Just a technical point related to that. The vertex amplitude that one gets starting from the Lorentzian quantum case, which Barrett and Crane are studying right now, as far as I understand, are the analytic continuations of the SO4 ones. So this is at least what I understand from the present work. So presumably, in some sense, there might be a possible way of continuing from one to the other theories in some way, but I don't understand how this could happen in detail.
I'll have to talk to you about that, because my best impression I was able to get out of their work on Lorentzian theory was that in the Lorentzian case you just get a divergent, purely formal expression for the vertex amplitudes. So even if it's an analytic continuation, if it's infinity or something like that, I'm not sure how much good it would do one. But it's possible. I think there's actually a lot of room for work in trying to make sense of those Lorentzian amplitudes. I wouldn't at all be yet willing to throw in the towel and just say that they're ill-defined. Yeah.
I just want to understand better the general rule for the amplitudes. I mm-hmm. thought when you first discussed it, you said there would be an amplitude for vertices and edges and faces or something, and some were like propagators and some were like...
Yeah. I got lazy and only started telling you the rules for the vertices.
Well, that's what I was wondering.
Because that's sort of the most exciting part. But there are the rules you do also calculate amplitudes for the spin foam faces and spin foam edges, and you need to stick them in there.
And each one is a complex number, and you just multiply all those numbers up? Is that
yeah,
right?
That's right. And
they
then
don't
sum
sort of
over
get
everything.
Stitched together in some way.
No, you just multiply them all together. If you look at a Feynman diagram, that's really what you do too, right? You take these vertex amplitudes and these propagators and multiply them together, and then you integrate over whatever things you need to integrate over. Here, those integrals are becoming sums because the group is compact, so the representations are labeled in a discrete way.
This is a question I suppose I could ask to a number of people, but I may as well ask. You went first. This goes back to one of your early transparencies where you were talking about spin networks in space and the area operator in terms of intersections of a spin network with a surface.
Mm-hmm.
I understand, I guess my question is, what do you mean by a surface in this mm-hmm. context? I understand what that would mean if you had a spin network embedded in some three-manifold and then talked about mm-hmm. an embedded surface in that three-manifold.
Mm-hmm.
But if the space really is just a spin network, should I just think of this area operator as an operator that in itself defines a surface by defining mm-hmm. areas, or is there... Why is it a surface?
Well, so in that slide, I was presenting results from canonical quantum gravity. I was talking about the kinematical Hilbert space. So there you really do have a three-dimensional manifold that the spin networks are in. and we haven't imposed any of the constraints like modding out by diffeomorphism or something. So there's no, so we really can talk about a surface with a well-defined location in that three manifold at that level and talk about the intersection of the spin network. So there's nothing particularly problematic. So the interesting part of your question comes when we try to then go to this more radical state of mind where we start thinking of the spin network as itself the complete description of space. And I think you gave the only possible answer to that question, namely that in that context, when we talk about a surface, we simply mean a way of labeling certain edges of the spin network, which we think of as being the point at which this, quote, surface intersects the edges. But until we get a lot further along in developing the dynamics of the theory, we won't have much else to say. So this surface is just sort of a kind of a virtual thing, which is a way of thinking about marking certain edges. Notice that, that same kind of question also comes up when you start worrying about imposing the constraints. When you impose the diffeomorphism constraint, the question comes up. Carl was just talking about it earlier. When you look, then the states are spin networks modulo diffeomorphisms, so you can't talk about where one of those intersects a particular surface in three-dimensional space. And so I think the answer to that question is, again, you just have to label certain edges of the spin network and say that's where the surface is. In other words, in a truly background-free setup where the space and the state of space are the same thing, the only way you can locate things is relative to the state itself, not relative to some coordinates. So I just want to just push to that position, it seems.
So you said you had a few thoughts on the connection between these spin foams and the string diagrams, but refrained from giving them. So if you hadn't restrained yourself, what would you have said?
Okay. So you can consider, you can take one of these spin foam models that's pretty well understood, like, say, the three-dimensional BF theory with cosmological constant, where everything converges, we can calculate to our heart's content, and so on. And now you can calculate the amplitude for a spin foam of a certain special sort, namely a spin foam that is basically just a surface without any intersections or anything, just a two-dimensional closed manifold, which is just labeled by a single representation of your gauge group. And then it turns out what amplitude you get, well, that amplitude turns out to be the same sort of amplitude that you'd get from doing calculations in the GMod, G-gauged, WZW model. To take the simplest case, say if your surface was a torus, and you say sum over all labelings of the surface, what number do you get? It's just the partition function for the GMod, G-gauged, WZW model for the torus. So what I'm saying is that, in a sense, what seems to be going on here is that, and this is sort of just my vague impression of what may be going on here, is that normally string theorists first work with conformal field theories, but then if they want, they can go over to work with this topological theory, which they come up with from the conformal blocks of the conformal field theory. And
the
topological
subset of the theory, right?
Yeah, it's a kind of sub-theory. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so when you do calculations in that sub-theory, you get the same thing as when you consider spin foams without any intersections. And that makes sense to me because in string theory, the interesting part of the string propagation amplitude has to do with its interaction with the background metric. Here in these spin foam models, there's no background metric, so you're not going to get anything interesting by just calculating the amplitude of a spin foam if it doesn't have any intersections with itself. Here all the interactions occur with the intersections. So here what we're doing is we're taking that kind of topological theory and supplementing it for rules that describe what happens when surfaces intersect each other. And I can imagine someone attempting to come up with some background-free formulation of string theory where they would give amplitudes corresponding to what happens when some strings intersect each other. And that's sort of, in a sense, what we're doing here.
So a big concern in the canonical approach to this subject is, as far as I can understand, this Hamiltonian constraint. When you got onto the spin foams, you didn't say much about that. And I sort of guessed that this was because the background triangulation allowed you to gauge fix the appropriate symmetry. Is that what's happening, or what is happening?
Well, so the theories that we know, so there are only some theories that are well understood enough so that I can give you a really complete kind of answer to what's going on. So, and those theories are these topological quantum theories, the ones with no local degrees of freedom. So let me at least say what's going on for those, and then we can talk about what's happening for the interesting theories that we don't know so much about. So with the topological quantum field theories, like this 2 plus 1 Riemannian quantum gravity, you can use... You can triangulate space-time a particular way, look at spin foams that are adapted to that triangulation, and calculate transition amplitudes to your heart's content. Now, suppose you take your space-time to be some two-dimensional manifold across the unit interval. So, sort of boring space-time, topologically speaking. Then you get a certain operator, and that operator turns out to be, first of all, independent of the triangulation that you picked. And then second of all, it's a projection operator. Its square is equal to itself. And you can compare back to the canonical approach, and you can see that this projection operator is just the projection onto the physical states, that is, the states that satisfy all the constraints of the theory. And that is what one would expect. That is, you can write down sort of heuristic path integral arguments that suggest that if you do the path integral over one of these space-times that's just a space cross an interval, that the operator you get for that should be the projection onto the solution of the constraints. That argument is, in the path integral language, is full of room for questions and doubts, but here we're in this context, one can see that that's really what's happening. So then you can hope that something like that would happen in four-dimensional theories, or theories with local degrees of freedom. You could hope that you could figure out the projection onto the solutions of the constraints by calculating these transition amplitudes in the spin foam model. Personally, I'm not too optimistic about that working out, actually. I think that the Hamiltonian constraint, personally, is a very deep problem, and I think it's a problem that we'll only deal with by understanding things in a quite different way, which will make most of what people have said about it so far not even be very relevant anymore.
But the current situation is that you do the spin foam without worrying about the constraint, and then you hope that the amplitude vanishes if the constraint isn't satisfied.
It projects any physical state onto the part that's the physical part. That's what one would hope. Right. Okay. So you could now... You know, proceed and calculate away here and see if it seems like it's working out.
I just had a comment since there are other people I'm not doing anything on Hamiltonian constraints, so I can stand out and say a few things basically. But I think you express a point of view which I think is not really shared by many other people, particularly Carlo is going to talk, I think, about the status of the Hamiltonian constraint tomorrow. And I think in other people's
minds... Which part of my point of view was?
That you are very pessimistic that this projection will have will be useful, this last part of view.
Uh-huh.
And you've started by saying right at the beginning that somehow... you said that the Hamiltonian constraint is the toughest part of the subject, mm-hmm. but one doesn't have any ideas. I think that's not the case, and I think both Carlo and Jorge will actually
I didn't mean to
ideas.
Say that one has no ideas. Maybe I just meant to say I don't have any ideas.
Okay. My question was about the following thing, which so at one stage you said that this model that you had, the Crane-Barrett model,
uh-huh.
that model in some sense should give you You'd hope that it, some sense it should give you general relativity, but
some funny kind of general relativity, right, with Riemannian.
Right, with Riemannian, right. But you mean sort of a kind of a triangulation version of general relativity, something like a Rege calculus version or what? Because you're not summing all triangulations here, so what did you mean by your hope?
Well, that's part of why I just hope, right? But I don't know what I mean, so I can only hope. But for example, the kind of thing you could try to show is take a manifold, chop it up very finely into lots of triangles, and now start calculating amplitudes for all sorts of spin foams that are compatible with that fixed but fine triangulation. Or maybe more realistically, maybe try to calculate the expectation value of something or other that you're interested in as a sum over all these spin foams. You could hope that in some sense, and this, I don't understand this well enough to make it very precise, in some sense that the spin foams which dominate the sum are describing geometries which are close to classical solutions of Riemannian general relativity. The last part, close to solutions of general relativity, that at least I have some idea of how to make sense of, because I know how for each of these spin foams to describe a whole bunch of geometrical properties of the triangulated manifold. For example, I know the areas of all the triangles in the manifold, and I know some other stuff too. So you can imagine someone being able to look at one of those discrete geometries and say, you know, this is sort of close in the large scale view to a solution of the Riemannian Einstein equations. But anyway, that no one has done that. The closest that people have come to doing that, which is I think something at least non-trivial, is that so from the Rege calculus, you can calculate an action for a four simplex whose edges are labeled by lengths. And it turns out, well, so you could hope that e to the I times that action would be related to this vertex amplitude that Barrett and Crane calculate. So one thing John Barrett has shown is that something like that, although not so naive, is true. Namely, in the limit where these spins become large, this vertex amplitude approaches some numerical factor times the cosine of the Rege action. The fact that you're getting a cosine instead of e to the I has to do with the fact that, well, it's still a little bit mysterious, but it certainly also happens in three dimensions where people are more familiar with these things. And it has something to do with the fact that knowing these areas doesn't completely determine the shape of the tetrahedron. It determines it only up to reflection. And so somehow the fact that cosine is a sum of two exponentials is what's making this happen.
Thank you. Two comments. First, I wanted to add something in relation, Simon, to your question about the relation between the Hamiltonian constraint and this picture. I will say more tomorrow in my talk about that, but I think this is important. A simple mind piece of answer, which is the following. One can think of separating a kinematical part, everything up to the Hamiltonian constraint, and a dynamical part, so to say, the Hamiltonian constraint. And in this formulation of the theory, one can think of separating the vertex, the amplitude of the vertex, the rule that says what precisely is the topology and the amplitude of the vertex from the spin network and its kinematics. Now, the roughly, and this is true only within a certain model in detail, roughly if you take a canonical formulation with a given vertex and you go to the spin form formulation, and tomorrow I will discuss how one can do that, the specific form of the Hamiltonian constraint that you have determines a specific amplitude in this case, which, if you think for a moment, is exactly what happens in usual quantum field theory. If you have a Hamiltonian formulation, you have a certain term in the Hamiltonian, which is exactly what determines the Feynman graph amplitude. Now, of course, this has to be taken with a grain of salt. I mean, it might be that there are vertices that actually do not come from Hamiltonians and all possible pathology of that. But I think intuitively this is the relation. The amplitude, a certain given amplitude corresponds to a certain given Hamiltonian. Mm-hmm. The second comment, this is independent, this is rapid. It's about what Abai was saying. I think you would agree that to any given fixed triangulation, the theory will never be able to approach all possible classical solution of generativity. In some sense, any given fixed triangulation defines a theory with a finite number of degrees of freedom. So it, in any case, there should be some limit of fine triangulation or some irregular triangulation or something in order to get the classical limit.
Right. One certainly doesn't expect that the full theory should come out of a fixed triangulation. That would only at best be suitable for describing sort of space-time histories where things were varying slowly compared to the mesh given by the triangulation.
Well, let me be provocative and ask, well, why not? Namely, people do this in QCD, namely they take the action, discretize it in a lattice that is square, and of course they get something finite. But then they notice that that theory that is truncated in a lattice that is finite suddenly happens to have a phase transition where correlation lengths diverge, and therefore the spacing is irrelevant. That's what makes the theory really worthwhile, not just because it's finite. Are you expecting something like that will happen here? That has an added bonus, by the way, that is that when you write these little vertices, or the equivalent thing for QCD, you're not too concerned about details of them because higher order details are all washed out by this phase transition. Is your view that something like this will happen here for gravity?
Well, I don't think you see a phase transition in QCD cut off on a finite lattice. I mean, you may see signs that there should be a phase transition, but you certainly don't see a phase transition in the technical sense of some quantity becoming non-analytic. But maybe you're mainly meaning to say that you can do useful calculations on a very small finite lattice in QCD. And so I'm certainly not claiming to rule that out here. I mean, Carlo's remark was sort of more of a saying that you're losing something when you go to a finite lattice, just as we all believe, I think, that QCD is not really a theory of a 64 by 64 by 64 by 64 grid. But the more useful question is, can you extract something useful and interesting out of small discretized spacetimes? And I don't have any strong feeling about that. I think one would have to calculate around and play around with these things. I think the main thing that I think needs to be done with these spin foam models actually is to develop ways of actually calculating things with them that are not for the topological theories where people understand them very well, but for the theories that are not topological, actually just getting out answers, like seeing how, for example, life expectations of Wilson loops depend on the area spanned by the loop. I think that's a kind of question you could actually ask here. And then it's a matter of developing computational tools for calculating them, both numerical and then also analytical. I'm getting interested, for example, in considering theories that are perturbations of topological theories, so you can develop some kind of perturbative approach to doing these calculations. But right now, you know, this could be a wonderful theory that approximates Riemannian gravity beautifully, but we have no way of knowing because we just don't know how to get in there and grind out those numbers yet. I guess Bob had a question for a while.
He was first, and Bob was next.
This is a technical question about this, again, projector and Hamiltonian. So you mentioned that in the context where the space is compact and the space-time is the space cross an interval, you expect the spin foam model to be related to a projection operator. Just technical question. At the time you were discussing this in your talk, you had a picture on the board which was similar but different, which was two spatially compact geometries that were different, different topology separated by a cobordism.
Uh-huh.
And I just wonder, do you mean to imply that in that case the spin foam, the sum would not be associated with the projection, or is that also in the same context?
It wouldn't be a projection because it's not even an operator from the same space to itself, right? People working on topological quantum field theory seem to feel free about to talk of such a thing as a transition amplitude for a state on one choice of space to turn into a state on some other choice of space. If you're trying to give that more physical meat and asking what do you mean by a transition amplitude in that kind of context, it's a little bit tricky to say. So whenever you have any cobordism, you can think of it as first you've done a projection operator onto the physical states at both ends. You can always stick little cylinders at both ends of your cobordism without changing it. So whatever the answer to the meaning of those operators is, it's an operator that solely deals with physical quantities.
I guess what I was wondering is, within this framework, do you leave open the possibility that physical states might necessarily be superpositions of or combinations of things with different apparent spatial topologies?
I don't see any reason why it's particularly fruitful to do that, as long as you're working with spin foams in a particular manifold. In these more abstract theories, where you just have the spin network is the only description of the state, then you have to do something like that, or even more radical. You don't know a priori which manifold it's in.
Yeah, returning to the kinematical Hilbert space and canonical quantum gravity, I mean, you said the spin networks gave you an orthonormal basis. Now, when are two spin networks considered to be different? I mean, if they're abstractly the same but embedded differently,
then
they're considered different.
Yes, that's
so
right.
You have
You can state precisely what those equivalence relations are. So certainly reparametrizing the edges is not different. Moving the edge ever so slightly makes it completely different, that is, orthogonal to what it was before.
So
there are a few other things you can do without really changing it.
So this is definitely a non-separable Hilbert
space. Right, it's a non-separable Hilbert space, and that people have various attitudes towards that. Some people, for example, try to say, well, part of the reason why it's a non-separable Hilbert space is you haven't imposed the constraints yet. I think people are actually a bit too optimistic about that as a way to deal with a non-separability. For example, you hear people saying that the diffeomorphism constraint is enough to get rid of the non-separability, but in fact it's not, because there's sort of moduli spaces of intersections that are inequivalent and under diffeomorphism. So even diffeomorphisms doesn't wipe out that non-separability. Now you could say, well, maybe the Hamiltonian constraint saves you, but you know, until we know about the Hamiltonian constraint, that's just a black box. And this is one of several issues that's gradually pushed me more towards a combinatorial or piecewise linear type formulation of thinking about things, because then you can get separable Hilbert spaces, which I like.
So actually, just to follow up, I mean, is it known that there are any states in this Hilbert space that satisfy, I mean, is it known what the diffeomorphism constraint is as an operator? Let's put aside the Hamiltonian constraint.
Ah, very good.
What it is,
that's why I'm so pessimistic about the Hamiltonian constraint. One reason is, so we certainly know how diffeomorphisms act on this space, and one can construct a smaller space, which one calls the space in which the diffeomorphism constraint has been imposed, and that was done by Ashtekar, Lewandowski, Meroff, Morau, and Tiemann, and I believe that they do it right. And but what? Oh, I would never say anything like that. maybe what I meant by that do it right remark is that while all that is true, you do not have any operators on the original kinematical state space, which you would call the diffeomorphism constraint. Because although the diffeomorphisms act as unitary operators on the space, they're not a strongly continuous action. That is, changing the state ever so slightly completely makes it orthogonal. So there's no self-adjoint operators which generate this this action. And I think actually that that's a sign that if you're going to go over, either something's wrong, or else you're going over into this more discrete way of viewing the world in which you don't expect that this kind of continuity is holding anymore. And if you're willing to accept that way of looking at things with a diffeomorphism constraint, I don't see why on earth you should expect anything other to happen with the Hamiltonian constraint. In other words, I don't see why people should think that the diffeomorphism constraint should not exist as an operator and then still be going around hoping that the Hamiltonian constraint is a well-defined operator. And that's part of what pushed me over towards this spin foam stuff, because I think that stuff could make sense even when the Hamiltonian constraint is not well-defined as an operator. Now, I think other people have very different views on this from me. I know people in this room are also taking the point of view that we can use spin foams to actually understand the Hamiltonian constraint. And I should also add that even if it's not an operator in the technical sense of a self-adjoint operator, it could still be something that's almost as good. I mean, analysts have lots of ways of getting you into trouble, but they also have lots of ways of getting you out of trouble too. I know, because I used to be one. So there are things that are sneakier than operators that it could be.
We'll take one last question from Matt. We're running out of time.
I wanted to get back to the issue of QCD. You were pretty tough on QCD in the sense that you're saying there's no such thing as a phase transition, but
I said in a finite, it's just a general fact about statistical mechanics I was trying to make, that you don't see non-analytic functions of your parameters in the finite volume.
People do analytic stuff in infinite lattices anyway, but never mind. That's not the issue I want to get to. Issue I want to get to is that the thing about QCD that's important is that you get a second order phase transition, roughly speaking, because the coupling constant is dimensionless. This means there's no scale in the problem. You get a second order phase transition. Your correlation length goes to infinity in lattice units. Mm-hmm. You lose that in gravity. You've got a dimensionful parameter, the Planck length. Mm-hmm. If there's a phase transition at all in any form of lattice quantum gravity, there's no reason to believe it's going to be second order. All the picture you get from QCD mm-hmm. is likely to be grossly, completely misleading.
Yeah. I don't believe I'm doing lattice quantum gravity when I'm doing this, by the way. I'm not. I mean, you see that this is actually a rather thing different. Some people say, you should now, this is all fine, but now take the continuum limit. But that's not at all the approach being taken here. The idea is that there is this smallest distance scale in space-time, and we're not going to try to look at things that are smaller than that, so that there's no continuum limit. That's why I refer to the large scale limit. That is, in a particular situation, if you view it from a very coarse grained perspective, it may look like something classical and familiar. And I think that's what one should look for. But it's very different from just taking the continuum limit in the sense it's often done in quantum field theories on a background manifold. I mean, a background geometry.
Okay, let's thank John again.
Oh, I forgot to mention I have some papers I'm giving away over there. If you want to read about this stuff.
For a limited time only.
Yeah.
Turn the thing off. Okay. Don't embarrass yourself on the